But I would like to invite another dear friend who I'm delighted to have at the Middle East Center, Dr. Aysan Nassar, would you please?
Thank you. Well, like my friends, I want to thank everyone who contributed to this event and invitation. And since the time is short, as some of my colleagues complained that they could not cover 1.5 million years in 15 minutes, I cannot cover 30 years of British mandate in 15 minutes, for sure. So I will not give you a history of the British mandate. I'd rather highlight some of the issues that I think in my contribution to this project, that I made in my contribution to this project. And let me start by saying history doesn't really start at a certain point. This periodization is not cut by knife. So even though the first British presence in Palestine was in October 1917 after the occupation of Beer Seba or Beer Sheva and lasted until the last High Commissioner left Haifa on May 14th, 1948, the British history did not start there or end here. In fact, we can argue that the fruits of Ottoman modernization in Palestine and in the region continued to flourish and blossom in the first decades of the British period, which means that modernization was not brought to us by the British, but was homegrown during the Ottoman times, whether in Palestine or in other areas. The few points I would like to highlight, some of them were mentioned briefly, and I'm not going to go into it, but clearly, biblical archaeology in the 19th century helped construct a certain vision of Palestine that is based on the textual sources of primarily the Old Testament, but to a lesser extent, the New Testament. And the maps that were produced in the 19th century by the Palestine Exploration Fund, why am I mentioning this, although I am talking about the British mandate, would become the maps, official maps of Palestine, when the British and the French and the Italians and others gathered in San Remo in 1920 to agree on the borders of the mandated regions that would be divided between the British and the French. Separating Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. And therefore, the map of Palestine, which we now call the historic Palestine, was actually the biblical map produced based on the biblical imagination of the 19th century British, particularly, but also the contribution of the others, which had nothing to do with the actual map, administrative maps that existed during the Ottoman period, where the district of Jerusalem was a mutasarrifiyya that included its borders from Jaffa to Jerusalem and south, even included Sinai, where the northern part of Palestine from Nablus on was part of the mutasarrifiyya or the district of Beirut. So there wasn't any consideration, not that I'm saying that the administrative maps are necessarily reflected the social, cultural, economic structure of the land, but at the same time, there was an arbitrariness in drawing the map of Palestine, which the British basically ruled, and that map was not based on any indigenous cultural, historical, familial, or what have you, conditions, but rather was constructed on the basis of certain imagination. What else is connected with the British rule in Palestine and the biblical imagination? Then we will move to the Balfour Declaration, or the Balfour Document, in which Palestine was promised as a Jewish homeland for the Jews, and the use was the term was national home, and national home means political rights, national rights, independence, blah blah blah, and with the guarantee that the religious and civil rights of the non-Jews, they were not even mentioned by name, they were reduced to non-Jews, which is about 90 to 95% of the population at the time, were not even worthy of being called whatever it is, Palestinians, Ottomans, Arabs, you name it. That's besides the point. The point is that the imagination, the biblical imagination, led, of course there are politics, I'm not talking about, I don't have time to go why and, you know, and all the British interests, but basically, Palestine was envisioned by the British as such. And in the first 2 years of the rule of the British in Palestine, Palestine was considered an enemy-occupied territory and was placed under a military rule. And one of its military governors was Roland Storrs, who also took another step in which he wanted to preserve, particularly Jerusalem, its historical nature. And by doing so, he created something called the Pro-Jerusalem Society, brought an, in a city planner from Egypt, a British city planner from Egypt, Ashby is his name, sorry, I forgot his first name, Charles Ashby. And what did they do? They studied Ashby, produced a new map of the city of Jerusalem, in which he erased the names of the neighborhoods of Jerusalem, replaced them by what we know today as the Jewish quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Armenian quarter, what else did I
say?
And the Christian quarter. Those were a number of quarters in which Jews, Muslims, Christians lived everywhere. So basically, the vision is these are various communities. We divide the city. We envision it that way. It did not reflect, of course, the composition of the various neighborhoods. Muslims continued to live in the Christian quarter. Christians continued to live in the Muslim quarter. The Jewish quarter was largely Muslim rather than Jewish. It did not affect that, but basically the construction of Palestine along lines of biblical and religious imagination was pivotal in the British project. What else did the British mandate after its establishment give us? It gave us the first High Commissioner for Palestine, Herbert Samuel, who himself was the first to produce a plan for a Jewish state in Palestine in 1915, way before the Balfour Declaration or the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was not adopted at the time by the British, but he was an active Zionist, and he became the governor of Palestine, the High Commissioner, this is the term. And what did he do? He produced something else that we're still stuck with today, which is he divided us into Arabs and Jews. To this day, we talk about Arabs and Jews. And what did he do with this idea? Well, there are two communities. Each one should be ruled differently by its own people based on its own tradition, on its own educational system, and on its own health system, etc., etc. So he produced, or the British produced for us, a new conception in which there are Jews and then everyone else is considered Arab. And to remind you, at that point, Zionist immigration was significant, but the Zionist immigrants, Jewish immigrants, were still a small minority. There were Palestinian Arab Jews who considered themselves Arabs. That was the So they were removed from the Arab community or Arab identity and designated to be similar to those European immigrants who came from Eastern Europe and from a variety of other places at the time. What else did we was a result of this policy? The main result is the Jewish community in Palestine or the Zionist community in Palestine got by the late 1920s to have its own government, more or less, under the leadership of what the British recognized as the Jewish Agency for Palestine, which was in charge of all the colonies that the Zionists started in Palestine, established in Palestine, where it had its own educational system, health system, labor union, you name it, basically, and complete autonomy we were hoping maybe the establishment of the Palestinian Authority in the 90s would lead to something similar, failed project for a variety of reasons, not the time to compare. But basically, the Jewish Agency was able to create institutions, including military militias, basically military force, which later on would become the Israeli Defense Force. They even kept the word defense because the main organization, military organization, was the Haganah, the defense. Okay, so here we, within the British mandate, there was already not just the roots, but a Jewish Zionist state was being created with an army. And then comes the World War II. And immediately, a large number of Jews from Palestine, from the Jewish immigrants in Palestine, volunteered in the British Army to fight in Europe. And they had a condition that they must be in one Jewish, I don't know if what's the right term,
brigade.
And that that brigade trained, it did not actually fight, but it trained well, and become, when it came back to Palestine after the war, it becomes an important component of the military force of what would become Israel, and would play a pivotal role in the destruction of Palestine and its erasure from the map and the expulsion of its people. So the Zionists, the British, basically enabled Zionism. Of course, there was an Arab resistance, was not highly organized. Variety of official, you know, from the Arab executive to the Arab higher committee, etc., to various parties were established, but they did not have the power. They were not enabled to create their own institutions fully, partially because of the British, but also partially because of their failures. And let's talk about failures. In 1936, and I think that's an important failure on the side of the Palestinian leadership, a six-month strike took place to protest against Jewish immigration and British policy. And what did the strike result in? The strike took place in the main port of Palestine, the port of Jaffa. What did the Zionists do? In 6 months, they built a new port in Palestine, in Tel Aviv. By the end of the Palestinian Revolt, or what's known as the Arab Revolt, 1939 and beginning of World War II, the main port in Palestine was the port of Tel Aviv, with Zionist employees, Jewish Zionist employees, rather than Palestinian, Arab, Jewish, and British together, as it was the case of in Jaffa. And what did that mean? That meant that illegal immigration, Jewish immigration to Palestine increased. Smuggling of weapons increased dramatically. Of course, we have many other failures. I'm not saying we caused our, but we were also unable to work together to think ahead, of course, and to present a concrete plan. And then we come to the post-1945 to 1948, in which basically, due to British measures against the revolt, Palestinian society was basically in ruins. The British, during the 3 years of the Palestinian revolt in the late 30s, bombed from air Jenin and many other cities and towns, Jaffa and parts of Haifa as well, and Palestinians who lost their lands were pushed into the cities to become workers, laborers, restricted primarily to work in Arab projects because the Zionist movement and its labor union, the Histadrut, had a policy of Jewish labor. So no more.
2 minutes.
Okay. Anyway, so we'll skip this. So therefore, we arrive at the point of the Nakba, the partition of Palestine, adopted against the will of the Palestinians, the people of Palestine, against the will of their neighbors. They were not represented in the vote. Of course, they were not consulted, even though there was a commission. Partly some of them boycotted, others participated, but they did not succeed. But the Zionist movement, perhaps due to the succeeded in that. And then we had the establishment of the State of Israel and the arrival of the Arab armies ill-trained without any coordination between each other. Their numbers were minuscule compared to the 90,000 or so Zionist fighters in Palestine. And with the Zionist movement, with its own institutions, which with its own vision, military plans, we found ourselves people of nowhere. Palestine disappeared from the map. We became Arab refugees in other people's countries. And we continued, despite all our struggles, at least we regained the name Palestine once again, but we continue to, and we are threatened more, as was mentioned before, to continue to become more and more people of the world without any passport of our own, any nationality or any state. So this is, of course, not a history of the British Mandate, but I wanted to highlight some of the elements that our friends, the British, contributed to our misery today.
Well, thank you, both of you.